It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's National Hispanic Heritage Day. We'll hear about a thriving Latino cultural scene here in Wisconsin.
First, two Democratic state lawmakers are proposing some significant changes to the state's troubled job agency, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation.
In a news conference earlier today, Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca of Kenosha and State Senator Julie Lassa of Stevens Point called for the end of WEDIC and the creation of a new two-pronged entity which would handle similar functions.
Senator Julie Lassa joins us to talk more about that proposal. Senator Lassa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, thanks, Veronica. Thanks, Rob.
So you, along with Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca, are calling for the end of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and the proposal of a new model. Why now?
Right. Well, we have all seen, based on the second scathing audit that came out from the Legislative Audit Bureau back in May, which was quickly followed by a number of investigative reports about the mismanagement and failures at WEDIC, and we believe that it is time that we end the failed experiment that really has been rife with mismanagement and failures. I mean, I think so many people are familiar with the story about Building Committee Inc., which was a failing company that former DOA Secretary Mike Hipsch was trying to get as well over $2 million in taxpayer money for. He was only successful in getting them $500,000, but we all know now that the owner of that company was a major donor to Governor Walker's campaign and wasn't going to be using that taxpayer money to create any jobs in Wisconsin, but he was going to be using it to potentially pay off other lenders, including a luxury car dealership. So we just believe that this agency has gone from crisis to crisis. It's time to pull the plug and actually focus on building a job creation agency that will help Wisconsin become a top 10 economic development and job creation state and really help create the good-paying, family-supporting jobs that people in Wisconsin deserve and they really need.
Well, tell us about your new proposal, this two-pronged entity. How would that work?
Sure. So we are proposing this hybrid agency. First, we'll return all the economic development programs to a public agency, which we're calling the Wisconsin Department of Economic Opportunity. And the second prong is a public-private board, the Badger Innovation Corporation, that will really help market and promote Wisconsin. It will be piece of the agency that would lead trade missions, recruit businesses, and assist with marketing and industry cluster development all across the state. It would also, having this public-private arm, will also enable us to raise private funds for economic development activities. But I think what's really important about returning this to a public agency is that the loans, grants, and awards would come from the Wisconsin Department of Economic Opportunity, which would be a state agency that would be required to follow open meetings laws, open records laws, and there would be much more transparency and accountability there than there is currently with the WEDC.
We're talking right now with Democratic State Senator Julie Lassa. She's with us to talk about a new proposal to replace the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation with a hybrid entity to create jobs. And looking at this new entity that you've just described, you still have a private corporation owned by the state and a state agency. How do you see this as being significantly different from the old Department of Commerce and then WEDIC alongside that?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked that question. What is really important is that the awards process would be put back into the state agency so that all of the transparency and accountability and state laws would be followed. We know that WEDIC has had a very troubled history with cronyism potentially happening in a number of awards, as well as the as well as WEDIC just not following state laws as well as the board's own policies. So this is one of the ways to make sure that we're properly vetting companies who are interested in receiving taxpayer assistance in order to build their business and to add jobs all across the state. And I think that's what's really important. And also, when WEDIC was created, I don't believe that Governor Walker and the Republicans in the legislature understood that it would cause federal funds to need to be shifted away from WEDIC because the federal government will not give federal taxpayer monies to a quasi-public-private entity. So nearly $25 million was sent over to the Department of Administration for community development block grants as well as HUD funding, Housing and Urban Development. So this would give us the opportunity to channel all of the state taxpayer money that WEDIC is spending on economic development, which is about $27 million, coupling it with the federal tax dollars that are coming through the community development block grants, so that we can have a much more comprehensive and cohesive economic development strategy. It also will allow us to bring the venture capital fund back from the Department of Administration also to be administered by the public agency. And in addition, with the Department of Commerce, when that was in existence, it also had performed regulatory functions, such as checking out building plans for commercial buildings and whatnot. We are not proposing bringing those regulatory duties back into this agency. We believe that it should be strictly focused on economic development and promoting good-paying, family-supporting jobs in the state of Wisconsin, because, as we all know, Wisconsin currently ranks 38th in the nation for job creation, and we have the dubious honor of being the number one state for the number of people falling out of the middle class.
Now, why would bringing some of that back under the state's umbrella help with the way that loans were awarded and help with the success of the agency and its mission?
Well, it's really important that we protect the decisions that are being made about which companies will be able to qualify for grants as well as loans or any other economic development assistance, that be done in a way where it's insulated for any possible cronyism or political pressure to award, as we saw with the award to BCI of $500,000, where there was a lot of political pressure that was brought to bear on Paul Jaden, who was the CEO of WEDIC at the time, to not only give that first $500,000, but to also provide over $2 million. We want to make sure that that type of thing does not happen. And by returning it to a state agency where there's a proper process that it goes through, where these deals are vetted thoroughly, where staff reviews are properly conducted, and we also want to make sure that we check these to make sure that these companies don't have any other financial or legal encumbrances, which we're now finding happened in a number of cases with awards that were given out by WDC.
And Senator Lassa, just briefly before we let you go, some critics have said, both Democrats and Republicans, that the quick turnaround time on the creation of WEDIC was responsible for some of the results at the end. Are you concerned about having a similar replication of that happening with this model?
Right, and that's why we were very careful in how we crafted this proposal to make sure that there was an adequate transition time, because I do believe, and that was borne out by the LAB's audit as well as WEDIC's own auditors, that there was a failure to make adequate plans for the transition from the Department of Commerce to WEDIC, which set up a lot of the problems that have happened with the agency. And we want to avoid that by making sure that there is the governor would appoint a transition a committee that would be made up by of business leaders, economic development specialists from different areas across the state, legislators, and university staff, as well as WEDC board members and staff, so that we can plan for an orderly transition to make sure that the same mistakes that happened with WEDC in the very beginning, with their failure to plan, do not happen with this. And we're very cognizant of making sure that there is that adequate transition from conception to planning. Then the structure would be included in the governor's executive budget and would move through that process. And if after 6 months, after that budget is signed into law and goes into effect, if the agency feels that it still needs more time, they'd be able to go back to the Joint Finance Committee to ask for more than the 6 months that they were given, so that we do this correctly. And economic development, when you have so many people who are counting on the state as well as the private sector community to be creating the good-paying, family-supporting jobs that are necessary in today's society to achieve the American dream, we want to make sure that we're very careful in how we proceed moving forward.
Senator Lassa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
That was Democratic State Senator Julie Lassa. She joined us to talk about a Democratic proposal to replace the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Today is National Hispanic Heritage Month, and our next guest has been involved in a long-term effort to highlight Hispanic writing and culture here in Wisconsin. As an editor of a series of books called I Didn't Know There Were Latinos in Wisconsin, he's collected essays, poems, stories, and more from writers around the state.
Oscar Morales joins us now. He's a poet and the director of the Omega Institute in Madison. He's speaking tomorrow night at 7 at the Verona Public Library. Oscar, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, you published the first book in this series, I think, about 25 years ago, and the new installment is subtitled Three Decades of Hispanic Writing in Wisconsin. What's changed over the last 25 or 30 years for the Latino community here in Wisconsin?
Well, a couple things have changed. In the last decade, it's been reported that there's over 300,000 Latinos, which makes us the number one minority group in the state of Wisconsin. And here in Madison, we're 20% of the student population, making us the largest Latino population in the history here in Madison.
Is it still possible, as it might have been 30 years ago, for someone now not to know that there are Latinos here in the state?
Well, I think I think we're everywhere. I saw a recent study that said there's more Latino students in all the small districts throughout Wisconsin than there are in the major districts of Milwaukee, Racine, and Kenosha.
As we mentioned, it's National Hispanic Heritage Day, and when we think of an ethnic heritage, we often think of it as, you know, the past, the family traditions, ties to the old country for immigrant communities. In these books, though, you're focusing on new writing. Why was it important to approach Latino identity in the state as, I guess, a current, creative, evolving concept?
Well, each of the writers, whether they're poets or short stories, talks about they have a presence here in Wisconsin, but a part of that presence is based on that history of where they come from, whether it's from Mexico, where a lot of people come from, or from the different the countries from where my wife came from Colombia or Latin America. There is a sense of longing for home, but in another sense, this is our home, and we're trying to really create our presence here, and it's a very diverse experience for everyone.
Yeah, with that diversity of experience, however many generations a family has been here, from one to maybe 10, I don't know, all the different countries, different parts of the country people might be from, do you still see in the writing and the three volumes you've done common themes emerging?
Well, you see the common themes of family, of the use of the use or lack of use of the Spanish language, the sense of the bringing the culture and food and language of their home countries and the customs and traditions. So it's trying to preserve the past and create a new future.
Can you tell us in the new volume, tell us about some of the writings that that you're really excited about, that you were glad to put out into the world?
Well, probably my favorite one is my youngest son, Javier. wrote a series of haikus. He was living in Colombia, his mom's native land, and he wrote some pieces about becoming himself, a better version of himself, understanding himself. And we also have a writer, Luana Monteiro, who wrote a short piece about she went home to Brazil, and it took her a while to realize that she had been in the United States for 20 years, had picked up a lot of mannerisms and a lot of customs of being here in the United States, and that made her less Brazilian. And once she accepted that, she really became a part of being Brazilian again.
Talking to Oscar Morales. He is the editor of a series of books titled I Didn't Know There Were Latinos in Wisconsin, collecting essays, poems, and other writings from authors from around the state. A lot of times, Oscar, I think in the news and popular culture, when we hear the words Latino and Hispanic, we might instantly think of immigrants, people who are new here. But as you point out in the books, that's not the whole picture.
Yeah, I've been here for six years, but a lot of the writers are second and third, and I think we even have somebody that's been a fourth generation, and we do have some that arrived here. But it's a breadth of experience, and each generation, we had one writer talk about her challenges with speaking Spanish. She felt that her mother forced her to speak Spanish, and while she did and she honored her parents, she sort of resented it. And then once she had children and she was also married to a Native American, and as she started talking about language with her children, she realized that her children didn't learn Spanish, and she realized that, you know, her mother really knew better. And once, as we all do with our parents, we think that's not the way to raise children, and we realize our parents know more than we realize.
And now the books aren't just about Latino identity. They're also about Midwestern culture in a way. Can you talk about that element? What is uniquely Midwestern or Wisconsin about the writings you've collected?
Well, I think some of the writings, there is a unique Wisconsin experience, and it's not only the weather, it's the climate, it's how people are treated here. And I think Wisconsin has become, I know it's become a home for my family, and there's a lot of great things that the city of Madison in Wisconsin offers. I know my children ski, and they go, they don't go ice fishing, but they water ski, and they do a lot of things that their grandparents had no idea they could possibly do. So Wisconsin offers a lot of experiences for my children that I wasn't exposed to, and that most definitely my parents weren't.
As we mentioned, there are memoirs and essays, works of fiction in the books, but there's also, as you mentioned, poetry. Your son wrote some haiku. You're a poet yourself. What do you think is unique about poetry that can help capture some of the stories you're telling in the series?
I think it captures emotion. It gives, I read my poetry to the, I'm a member of the Downtown Rotary here in Madison, which is one of the 10 largest clubs in the world. And when I read poetry to the group, they were impressed that I was able to align them with the four tenets of the Rotary. Is it fair? Is it the truth? Is it fair to all concerned? And we became more connected. I share with them, I now feel like I was a member of the Rotary, because now they understand we have a common language, we have a common experience that we can now share with each other.
Well, talking about the idea about common experience, we have a lot of questions about gaps, divisions between ethnic groups, immigrant communities and others, black and white communities. From what people have written in your series, do you see those kind of gaps, or do you see bridges being built over time?
Well, I think more bridges being built. I have a poem that's called Why Did You Name Me Javier Dad? And I talk about how my kids have distinctly Latino names, Sergio Andres, Diego Jesus, Lorena Pilar, and how at a certain point, especially when they started school, they wished that they could change their names because they wanted to fit in. They wanted to, They wanted to not have a name that doesn't take up too much space. But as they got older, they embraced their name. They embraced that it was a special thing they could carry. It was a mirror to their own experiences. And I think when I share this poem, a lot of people talk about being named after their grandparents, and the name really carries who we are and is a big part of our identity. And at first, even though I'm talking about names, very Latino names, it comes full circle. Names really help us carry our history and our image forward.
Oscar, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That was Oscar Morales. He's the editor of I Didn't Know There Were Latinos in Wisconsin, Three Decades of Hispanic Writing. He's the director of the Omega Institute in Madison. He's speaking tomorrow night at 7 at the Verona Public Library. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The lines between politicians and celebrities continue to blur as billionaire real estate mogul and reality TV star Donald Trump continues to lead the field of Republican presidential candidates.
We have seen this before with former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, and before that, silver screen actor turned president Ronald Reagan.
I'm telling the truth, Doc. You gotta believe me.
Then tell me, future boy. Who's president of the United States in 1985?
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan? The actor? Then who's vice president? Jerry Lewis?
That clip from the film Back to the Future was from 1985. Here we are today seeing more and more celebrities crossing over into the world of politics.
Joining us now to discuss this phenomenon is Daryl West. He's vice president and director of governance studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of Celebrity Politics. Daryl, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be with you, Veronica.
Well, why are some voters attracted to celebrity candidates?
People like celebrity candidates because they come from outside the political world. So voters are very cynical about career politicians, think they've spent a lifetime doing deals. And so if someone has come from a non-political world, they often have great credibility. They are seen as white knights who can help clean up the process.
And does that mean there's this perception out there, too, especially if they come with their own full-to-the-brim bank account, like, say, Donald Trump, that people have the perception that they have the money they need. They're not susceptible to being bought by outside interests.
Exactly. Celebrities who are rich have that additional advantage of being seen as too rich to be bought. And in Trump's case, we've actually heard him make that argument. That's not uncommon. Rich business people who run for office often make that argument. They understand voters are cynical about career politicians, and so they see this as one of their prime virtues from the standpoint of public opinion.
Now, you've said that celebrities need politicians and that politicians also need celebrities. How come that is, and what's changed? It hasn't always been the case.
They need each other because each has a different kind of credibility. So politicians like to hang out with celebrities because Hollywood stars and athletes have credibility with a non-political crowd, people who are not conventionally involved in politics. So if you want to reach non-voters, celebrities are a great way to help you do that.
Now, I suppose a tendency is to be maybe a little alarmed about the trend of celebrities in politics. They may not have the depth of knowledge about certain issues that a politician may have based on their own background. But is it necessarily the way that that works? Is there a dumbing down of politics because of celebrities, or are there some benefits there too?
I mean, commentators often criticize these types of candidates by saying they don't know anything about the issues, they lack the depth of substance that we need in any type of major politicalship role. But there actually isn't a lot of evidence that voters care about this. I mean, for example, you mentioned the case of Ronald Reagan, and when he ran both as governor of California and then later as president, people said, well, the guy doesn't know enough to be a president. But voters felt that he had the right values. They felt that he had the judgment and leadership and vision that we expect of major political leaders. So those types of candidates often are not penalized for a so-called lack of knowledge.
Now, what about the way our culture seems to have changed? It seems as though everyone in America is maybe just one step away, one public disaster away from having their own reality TV show. What's changed in the culture at large?
Well, we certainly do see major changes in the culture, and the patterns of news coverage reflect this. There are many, what I call in my book, event celebrities, ordinary people who are cast into the public eye because they are involved in some event. It could be a natural disaster. It could be a horrific shooting. It could they could just be a witness to some dramatic event that takes place, and they can become celebrities in their own right. Some of these individuals become such big celebrities that they're able to run for office and do well themselves.
Well, we're talking right now with Daryl West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of the book Celebrity Politics. Let's turn to Donald Trump again now. Now, here is a celebrity with his own reality TV show, not to mention his background as a real estate magnate. He had all that going for him before he jumped into politics.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account?
Only Rosie O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't. For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Your Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks.
I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct.
Now, there's Donald Trump, a clip from the first debate there, and he is the outsider clearly coming into this debate. How did that play out to you, especially in that clip and the way he conducts himself on the national stage?
Well, if you just look at the public opinion polls, Trump did very well. You know, his numbers actually went up after that debate. A lot of people were very unhappy with him on that exchange and feel like he was demeaning women. But yet, within the GOP electorate, he was able to do well. And I think what that experience shows is what a lot of these celebrity politicians have. Because of their celebrity status, they're used to dealing with the news media. And so they're often very strong salespeople. They're the master of the comeback. They're quick on their feet. And so, you know, when they're in a debate setting or if they're giving speeches, they know how to present themselves to ordinary people. They know how to create that resonance that allows people to want to support them.
Now, the Trump candidacy has clearly touched a nerve with a lot of people who are interested in seeing an outsider come in with business, real-world experience. Is there any evidence that that sort of experience does translate to a lot of success and once you're in office and being an effective policymaker?
Not really. I mean, these types of individuals often do well at election time because they know how to raise money or they have their own money. They're very good at dealing with the media. They can relate well to ordinary people. But if you actually look at the cases of those who make it into office, business people are used to essentially issuing orders and having their subordinates carry them out. That clearly is not something that takes place in the political world. You know, if you're president, you can make speeches, you can issue policy proclamations, you can give orders of things that you would like to have happen. Members of Congress aren't going to do it, especially in this highly polarized era. So, you know, if by some chance Donald Trump becomes President Trump, he, of course, is going to confront a very different reality and a Congress that is not going to do the things that he promised to do.
Now, one thing that's hard to deny when you look at a Trump candidacy is that it's more entertaining because Donald Trump is there. I mean, he does tend to suck up a lot of the attention in the room from the other candidates. But as a whole, is it maybe a plus for politics that suddenly it's more of a spectacle? It's more entertaining to watch.
I mean, it could be a plus from the standpoint of Democratic politics if a entertainer like Trump is able to draw new voters into the process, just on the idea that the more people who participate, the better off we are. But, you know, Trump is entertaining, you know, in a now 16-person candidate field. He's able to clearly distinguish himself from the rest of the field. You know, they are mostly politicians, with exception of Ben Carson and Ms. Fiorina. So he is able to kind of distinguish himself in a way that's more entertaining, that resonates with voters, and clearly distinguishes himself from all the other career politicians.
Now, we have seen a lot of success with other candidates with the same similar profile. We've seen Ronald Reagan, we've seen Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jesse Ventura. Does that mean that this celebrity allure can last all the way through Election Day, or does there come a certain point where the luster comes off and voters want someone with a little more solid credentials politically behind them?
It certainly can last quite a while, and all of the individuals that you named ultimately won the election and went on to hold a major executive office. But there are some risks of these types of candidates. Voters do, although they don't expect these individuals to be policy experts, there is a threshold of knowledgeability that we expect of our leaders. So if you're a celebrity, it might be a low bar that you have to pass, but there is some knowledge base that is required. So, you know, recently we had a radio talk show host basically give Trump a pop quiz on foreign policy that Trump failed miserably. And so that's something he has to worry about. That will probably encourage other either debate moderators or reporters to ask him detailed policy questions. He does have to demonstrate enough knowledge to convince voters he can do the job.
Now, some people have actually called President Obama our first real celebrity president, living in that age of culture as we do now. Here's a clip of the president trading barbs with the host of the web series Between Two Ferns.
Hi, welcome to another edition of Between Two Ferns. I'm your host, Zach Galifianakis, and my guest today is President Barack Obama.
Good to be with you, Zach.
You know what I would do if I were president, Mr. President? I would make same-sex divorce illegal, then see how bad they want it.
I think that's why you're not president. And that's a good thing.
Sort of an absurd clip to listen to there. And this is the sort of the world that presidential candidates seem to have to be comfortable moving in now, though. But does it befit a commander-in-chief to put himself in a situation like that? Does it make him more accessible?
Well, that's an interesting clip because it shows Obama clearly being not very comfortable in that type of an environment. You know, it seemed to be a situation where some media advisor said, hey, you should go on this cable show. There's a youth audience. It's a good way to make yourself more accessible to people. Obama agreed to do it, but it was a very awkward interview, and it wasn't clear that Obama really enjoyed the experience. And so, you know, all of our current politicians face a new media environment. You know, there are more channels, more outlets, more demographic niches who need to be reached. And it's difficult to navigate that type of world, but it's like Obama's not the first person to do it. I remember in 92, Bill Clinton went on Arsenio Hall and played the saxophone, and at that time, that was a little scandalous. It's like, you know, is a candidate really lowering himself to appear on that type of purely entertainment show? But, you know, when you look at the last two decades, it's like all politicians now are going on these kind of shows.
We're talking right now with Darrell West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of the book Celebrity Politics.
And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you think that celebrity status helps or hurts a candidate? Maybe it's a good thing to have outsider celebrities run for office instead of career politicians. What does it take for someone from outside that political world to get taken seriously in the political world? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking to Darrell West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of the book Celebrity Politics. We've been talking about the blurred lines between celebrity culture and politics.
From Ronald Reagan to Arnold Schwarzenegger, Al Franken to, yes, Donald Trump. What do you think? Are you glad that Donald Trump is in the presidential race? Do you think he's bringing something there, making it more interesting, bringing issues to the table? Do you want to see him elected, or do you see him as a pop culture icon, not so much a politician? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you could post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our first caller, Michael in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I guess my comment is sort of more specific than general celebrity, though I don't think that it's a good thing that Donald Trump is getting so much press in the race. I think it's sort of shameful of the people responding to him. But more specifically, actually, the Between the Two Ferns show with Zach Galifianakis as the host is actually meant to be framed as sort of this awkward sort of standoffish environment between Zach Galifianakis as the host and his guest. So I would say that I feel that the president was rather successful with his appearance there in adapting to the environment, and I think that President Obama has really comported himself very well and adeptly, especially in appealing to the youth, kind of exemplified through his little video that he released on YouTube, where it shows him trying to dunk a cookie in a glass of milk, and the cookie's too big, and then he just shakes his head and says, "Thanks, Obama." So, that's my main point, really.
So the things you described are entertaining, but do you, Michael, want to see a sitting president of the United States awkwardly conversing with Zach Galifianakis, or does that somehow diminish the dignity of the office, do you think?
At this point, I guess I'm a little biased. I am a fan of President Obama. I think overall, at this point in his presidency, he's in his second term, and, you know, he's sort of shown a definite tendency towards a little bit of self-deprecating humor and that sort of thing sometimes. So I don't think it's not an international appearance that he's making. So I don't think there's really any harm. I'm sorry, my kids are loud. I don't think there's really any harm in him making a small appearance on a show like that at this point.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for your thoughts, Michael. Appreciate that. And there's Michael Darrell appreciating the president going on these programs, putting himself in these entertaining situations. Maybe it gives him another viewpoint of the president. But do you think that there's any danger to this, that if voters get too accustomed to seeing presidents in these sorts of scenarios, someone else comes along with fabulous credentials but a little less going for them in the cool department and the entertainment savvy department, and then they don't get the credit they deserve?
I mean, I think that is the risk of those types of shows. Obama actually has done very well. You know, he often appears at the Washington Correspondents' Dinner, has a comedy monologue, and is amazingly funny in a lot of those types of settings. And Michael is right that, you know, through appearances on the Two Ferns show, you know, he is able to reach a young audience, and he's been one of the most successful of our current national leaders in engaging young people in politics, which clearly is good. But it does create problems for everybody else. You know, Hillary Clinton tries to do stuff like that. Jeb Bush tries to do stuff like that. It almost always falls flat. So there can be politicians who are very knowledgeable and very substantive, but who just simply cannot navigate this new media terrain.
And we're going to go next to Arlene, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Arlene.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just happened to be listening. As far as the celebrity status goes, I personally, in the past, would have been a little cautious in that regard. Right now, I no longer feel that way. And the fact that one is in the media all the time, no matter how, isn't the main thing. It's what they're able to do for the country and around the globe. We're living in a very dangerous time. It's getting worse than ever, and for a variety of reasons that I really won't mention on the phone right now. But Donald Trump really does say what so many others are cautious about saying, they, for the obvious reasons. I think we need that kind of a person, and my opinion about him is that were he to be elected, I do believe he's the kind of person who would consider it important enough, aside from his personal status, that he would do his very best. I think he's a quick learner, and he would have enough sense to do the right thing at the right time for the right reason. And I think we're off track when we continue to talk about actors and funny and whatever it is.
Well, Arlene, let me ask you a question. Do you think that Donald Trump's his facility with the media, given his long time spent there on a reality TV show, do you think that informs the way he appears on camera and the way he conducts himself in a way that another candidate might not have that same sort of background and might appear completely differently. Do you think it informs it at all?
If it I didn't understand what you asked. If it what?
Does it influence the way that he comes off on stage?
It could, but I really feel that he wants to be as honest as possible in the end. And he does say what he could do or would do, and there are many who may be able to do something but don't say what they could or would do. I don't think it matters anymore what they do or don't say.
Arlene, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your points of view there. And Daryl, what about that? She says it's not really the celebrity stuff that's pushing Donald Trump. It's the fact that he seems decisive on a national stage.
Well, certainly the people who are supporting him like his leadership skills. They like what he's saying. He's articulating viewpoints that often have not been expressed, but, you know, clearly there is an audience for that. And Arlene is also right. Trump is completely comfortable in front of a camera, and so that gives him a kind of authenticity that many of the other candidates lack, and I think that's one of the reasons he's doing well. But on her other point that, you know, the critical aspect of this election is what are these individuals going to do for the country and how are they going to deal with this chaotic situation that exists in many places around the world? I think with Trump, everybody is still waiting to hear that. You know, he has nice slogans, let's make America great again, but we don't know what he's going to do. We don't know very much about his economic policy. We know very little about his foreign policy.
And thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate that. That was Daryl West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution.
A milestone today in the world of literature and mystery writing in particular. It is the 125th birth anniversary of author Agatha Christie.
She's the best-selling novelist in the world and almost the best-selling writer of any kind. She's number three in sales behind the Bible and Shakespeare. All told, her book sold somewhere between 2 and 4 billion copies.
Her number one seller, this is what I've read, it was And Then There Were None, and that was wisely renamed after a series of titles that were fairly offensive, really.
Public television fans might remember the TV version of one of her most famous creations, Hercule Poirot, in an early episode in the long-running series. The detective can't get excited about the cases available. He's got more pressing issues to deal with.
There's good stuff here, Poirot. Mysterious suicide, absconding bank clerk, missing typist.
Yes, but I am not greatly attracted to any of them, mon ami. I have many affairs of importance of my own to attend to.
Such as?
My wardrobe, Hastings. If I mistake not, there is on my new gray suit the spot of grease. You have noticed it, perhaps, eh?
No.
No? Well, it's only the one spot, you understand, but it is sufficient to trouble me.
Miss Marple is one of her other famous recurring characters. She was also a fixture on public television, though according to her family, Christie never really cared that much about TV.
Yeah, selling only outsold by Shakespeare and the Bible. Not too shabby for a mystery writer. She just really influenced the whole genre.
It makes me wonder why I haven't read more of her.
Yeah, I've only read a couple, and there's an almost inexhaustible series. So a vow today, I'll need to pick out a Christie novel and check it out.
Sounds good.